I did want to just thank Chris and Dazeen for the opportunity to come here and present some of the work that has been going on at the University of Alberta in association with the TRIA project. And so with this, I'm going to just give a brief overview of what the Integrated Genomic Landscape Map is, and then focus on some of the research that's being done specifically on the fungi within the Alberta group. And the co-authors here are specifically for the data that I'll be presenting on the fungi, but I do want to acknowledge that this larger integrated genomic landscape map is being worked on in collaboration with our partners at the University of British Columbia, the University of Northern British Columbia, the Canadian Forest Service, and Natural Resources Canada. So, as many speakers in this session have acknowledged, pine beetle, Dendrocnus ponderosa, has been an epidemic in Western Canada and has affected large tracts of forest in that area. And so the system is composed of three organisms. We have the pines, the beetle, and the fungi that are associated with that beetle. But really it's also these interactions, the interactions of the beetle and the fungus, and then those two symbionts on the tree itself, and it's these interactions that we really are interested in looking at. And just as you can survey a forest for different landscape characteristics, such as topography or temperature or species composition, so too you can survey a genome if you think about genome as a landscape of genes, of gene products, and the interaction of those gene products. And to do that, we need tools to be able to survey that genome. So just as a forester may use aerial surveys to survey a forest, so too we can use different markers to survey that genome. And for the course of this project, we're going to be looking at sort of two different classes of markers. The first are the neutral markers, which Brent had already mentioned. These, for example, are like microsatellites. They're selectively neutral, which means that those mutations do not affect the fitness of the organism. They're highly polymorphic and informative, and can provide us information about the population structure and the demographics of those of the species that we are looking at. On the other hand, we also have things like adaptive markers. These may be in things like single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs. And these are genes that may confirm adaptive variation and have been developed from functional studies that people here have talked about that may be linked to things like dispersal or detoxification of tree chemicals, pheromone production, cold tolerance, or drought tolerance. And the plan is to take these SNPs, so these adaptive markers, and survey the species within the mountain pine beetle system for this potentially adaptive variation. For the rest of this talk, I'm really going to focus on the neutral markers and talk about where we are with the fungi in relation to this. Now, as Brent had mentioned, we have developed a sampling scheme that is both hierarchical and simultaneous. What I mean by that is we have sampled at two different time points for 17 landscapes across that BC-Alberta range that Brent had shown on a map. And within those landscapes, we sampled three stands, and within each stand, we sampled 20 trees. 10 trees were unaffected by the beetles, and 10 trees were affected or attacked. And within the attack trees, we sampled the pine for DNA, as well as the beetles and the fungi. So this is a similar map that Brent had shown, and you can see in red the landscapes that we had sampled in this integrated, this hierarchical and simultaneous fashion. And what the plan is with this simultaneous sampling is to be able to integrate both the fungi, the pines, and the beetles to take their genomes and look at them simultaneously and to see if we can find correlations between those genomes or those genotypes and look at the genome and these interacting genomes as a sort of a multidimensional topography and really try to understand how these organisms are evolving together in relation to both the ecology and environmental conditions that they are faced with. And no one has really done this before at this scale or complexity. And this system, the mountain pine beetle system, really provides us a unique opportunity to do so. So for the rest of this talk, I'm really going to focus in on the work that we have been doing with the fungi. And so to date, we have almost close to 5,000 fungal isolates And these isolates have been taken from both the trees and the beetles. And we're going to address sort of a couple specific questions. First, we're going to look at the spatial and temporal distribution of the fungi associated with the pine beetles and survey these fungi for both intra and intraspecific variation at four different loci. And we're going to assess those loci for two things. First, for multi-locus identification, because for downstream applications, we want to be sure that the species of fungi that we're looking at are what we expect them to be. And then we also want to relate that genetic variation to the spatial distribution of the fungal species to see if there is a population structure within the species like what Brent was showing with the beetles. And then ultimately to integrate that fungal data with the beetles and the pine population genetic information. And so the three fungal species that we're going to be focusing on, Colette has already mentioned, but I'm just going to remind you here again. So there's many different fungi within these beetles, but we're going to focus on Grossmannia clavigera, Leptographium longicaudatum, and Ophiostoma montium. These were cultured both from wood samples taken from the galleries as well as from larvae or adults taken from the galleries. So we have both larval samples or beetle samples as well as wood samples of the fungi. These were subcultured and identified to morphotype based on cultural and microscopic characteristics. We were finding some strains that appeared to be sort of intermediate morphotypes, and these were classified as intermediates and then further characterized with the genetic information. In terms of molecular techniques, we used single spore isolates to ensure we had pure culture of the three main species, and we've done this on 400 single spore isolates and sequenced for four markers, EF1 alpha, actin, beta tubulin, and an anonymous marker that we have been working, although this only amplifies in longicaudatum and clavigera, and this is being characterized with Richard at the Canadian Forest Service. These sequence data were then compared to previously published data that is available in public databases and then built into both trees and to haplotype networks, which I'll explain later. So in terms of the morphological identification, it was in general found that there were very reasonably good characteristics both at the microscopic level as well as the cultural level to identify these morphotypes. But those intermediate cultures did prove difficult. And when you looked at the abundance of those and the presence of those species, those morphotypes on the landscape, we found a couple interesting trends. First, we found that longicaudatum was much more common in the northern landscapes and was almost nearly absent in the southern landscapes. And then Grossmannia clavigera and Ophiostoma montium were relatively more common in the southern landscapes, although they still were present in the north. And then we did find year-to-year abundance changes, so that sampling in both two different time points allowed us to see changes in the fungal abundance from year to year. And so now we're going to get into the molecular data to see how both the inter and the intraspecific variation can give us a sense of what's going on with these fungi. And so now just to give a quick background, intraspecific variation is really the differences between species. And this really allows us to help delineate the fungal species we're looking at, and it'll allow us to look for clustering that indicates unique or different species. Now the intraspecific variation are the differences within species. And this will give us insight into the evolutionary forces that are structuring populations within that species, and then can be correlated to the spatial distribution of this fungal species and its haplotypes to understand how it's moving and evolving within the landscape. So now I'm just going to briefly get into some genetic data. Now, what I'm going to show you here, these circle diagrams are what we call haplotype networks. And for those of you who've never seen it, I'm just going to give you a quick run through of what these are. So each circle represents a unique haplotype of this gene. And as you can see, the size of each circle represents the number of individuals that are contained or have that haplotype. And now the separation between these two circles, this is a single base pair difference. So a single mutation takes you from this circle to this circle. The dark circles indicate missing haplotypes. And so to get from here to here, this would be two mutational differences. And what we see here is, if you look in the, basically the color representation here is, in blue we have Leptogaryphium longicovatum, in green, Grossmannia clavigera, in orange, Leptogaryphium terebrantus, and in gray, Grossmannia aurei. So the really important thing here is we were finding species of fungi that we hadn't expected. And the morphological typing had failed to see. But this molecular typing did identify those and allowed us to get a better sense of the fungal species associated with the beetles that we were sampling. But also, we see that we have both intra, not only do we see the nice breaks between these species here, these missing haplotypes, we also find variation within the species. And this pattern is particularly consistent through the different loci that we are looking at. So both in actin and EF1 alpha, within beta tubulin, and that anonymous locus. And so we continue to see those breaks that suggesting that these are these are good species limits and markers that are clarifying the species that we're looking at. Now the story gets a little messier when you look at Ophiostoma montium. And now what we have here is we have the three loci that we were amplifying. And actin and EF1 alpha show a very sort of similar level of variation. But beta tubulin shows a much greater amount of variation with the individuals that we sampled. And what's really interesting is the individuals that were sampled in beta tubulin are exactly the same as those sampled in actin and EF1 alpha. So it suggests that this gene is undergoing differential selective pressures evolving at a different rate than these two loci and is going to take some additional examinations. Now one individual I'd like to point out is this little guy over here. He actually is so different he won't even join into the network. And so it suggests that there may be some cryptic species in the Ophiostoma montium group. And so now to get a real sense of how these genes, when you look at them all together, we concatenate it or join the different pieces of data together to give you a sense of how much variation in total we are seeing. And this gives us an even better sense of the grouping or the clustering of clavigera, of the four species that we were finding, and we really see these good, clean breaks between the species. And when you do this with montium, you also begin to see these sort of odd individuals pulling out, which may indicate that species complex. So there's a lot of variation both within and between these species. And so now to get a sense of how these different haplotypes, where they exist on the landscape, basically took a north-south gradient, basically choosing colors to represent the furthest north and the furthest south landscapes that we sampled. And what we want to do is take these landscapes and look at where those haplotypes fall. So this is that concatenated network that I had shown you before, but what you see is the number of individuals in the northern populations and the southern populations within the haplotypes. And so what you see in clavigera is that there are three main haplotypes that are shared among the northern and the southern populations. But what's interesting is that the unique haplotypes, so haplotypes that are found only in one or two locations, are only found in the south. So the south has more diverse populations than the north. And this pattern is also shown in longicovatum, where we have two very common haplotypes that are shared both north and south, but we also have these southern populations which are unique. And when you look at montium, this trend becomes even more apparent, where there's actually very few individuals or very few haplotypes that are shared from north to south, but the south again has a high number of unique haplotypes. So in the north we have about 7 unique haplotypes that are only found in the north, but when you go down to the south we have 14. And so again, this is continuing to support the idea that we do have a lot of diversity in the South that is not found in the North. And this is interesting because we're seeing a very similar pattern in the beetles. And so it'll be really neat when we can finally start to combine these two different data sets into that integrated genomic landscape map to see if we can find some similar trends or patterns that are affecting these two organisms simultaneously. And so what we can see here is that we have with the morphotyping, we found that there is a real spatial and temporal distribution that showed a north-south divide among the fungal species, and that we were finding year-to-year variation in abundance. And then that morphological typing was a good sort of first course screen, and we were able to identify the species. But we did find intermediate individuals that needed the genetic information to help clarify that identification. As well, we also found some species that we hadn't expected, and that genetic information did help us clarify that information. And so in terms of typing these fungi, these loci will be quite useful for typing for future work with the population structure and looking at that adaptive variation to ensure that we are looking at the correct species. And then if you look at the intraspecific variation, we are finding some spatial structuring within the and with the southern populations containing many more unique haplotypes than we're finding in the north. And that this really gives us a great hypothesis to test with more variable loci, such as microsatellites, that are currently being developed. And this will give us a much better sense of the structuring, but it does give us a sense that there is some pattern to find in the future. So the future directions is we hope to complete this multi-locus survey for fungi in all landscapes. And we also wish to add the ITS marker, which is a very commonly used marker within fungal work, and compare the amount of variation that the ITS shows relative to the other markers that we're using. In particular, we're really interested to see with in collaboration with Clement Su and Richard Hamlin at the University of British Columbia, what we're finding in terms of variation with the microsats within Grossmannia clavigera. And then we are really interested in the collaboration with Brett Murray at the University of Northern British Columbia to start assembling and looking at these two different systems simultaneously to see what type of population structuring we're finding when we look at them together. And ultimately, the goal is to take this data and integrate it with the pine data that is yet to be collected into that integrated genomic landscape map and try to understand how the system is evolving on the landscape and give us insight into how it may adapt and change in the future. And just to acknowledge again that this is a part of the TRIA project, and we have many collaborators throughout a number of institutions, as well as to acknowledge both the Genome British Columbia and Genome Alberta as our funding agencies. And so if there are any questions, I'd be happy to take some. Yeah?
You mentioned that there are some other fungi that you see over.
Yes. We only found maybe three or four individuals in the 400 single spore isolates that we had found. So they are present, but they aren't really abundant in the way that the Grossmannia clavigera and Elongia cavatum are abundant in the landscapes. So they may be more incidental than a true partner within the system. Alan?
The sample you've done in Alberta, the other populations of fungi and beetles are sampling, they're not the outbreak ones.
So that's actually an excellent question, and we aren't really sure, for example, like the Cypress Hills example you had suggested, we aren't sure where those beetles are coming from. We don't know if they're coming from the foothills area or if they're coming in further south from British Columbia. There has been a hypothesis that Canmore has contained an endemic population of pine beetle, but what's really neat is the microsatellite work with the beetles is really going to get at that question. Right now, we aren't sure. But given the observation of the huge beetle flight up north, those beetles are certainly part of the epidemic population that have come in. But what's going on in the south, we haven't yet figured out.
So in order to make this very interesting, you sample every year until the thing stops, and then you can just see the whole demographic shifts.
That, and we're trying to really get at that with the two-year sampling. Unfortunately, we don't have the budget to keep sampling in the intensity that we have done here. More sampling, more sort of, especially with the beetles, we could go out and sample throughout the year, but to do that simultaneous sampling, we won't be able to do that. Yes?
More just a comment. The Cypress Hills population calls to be endemic in the plateau. Does it reach that far in the last major outbreak? Yeah. And then nobody ever left.
Great.
Are there any further questions? So please join me in thanking Amanda.